Third Wednesday of the month, Bloomington, Mayor Hamilton, good to see you. Thanks for having us.
Nice to see you, Joe.
So Indiana primary over, low turnout. I guess it's not unexpected, but boy, you know, when you see the numbers and you think these are the people that you see in the restaurant, at the mall, at the grocery store, the elected officials that are right down your street, it's somewhat still disheartening to see such a low turnout.
Well, it is a little bit. I mean, I'd say a couple things. We always wish there were more turnout. And, you know, as an elected official, you're tempted to kind of ask somebody who's got an issue, well, did you vote in the last election when you're concerned about your government? But of course, we represent everybody, whether they vote or not. But I also think it's worth pointing out that Indiana continues to be one of the states that makes it the hardest to vote of any state in the country in terms of hours of voting, registration requirements, ID requirements, location requirements, all those things. And, you know, we shouldn't do that. We should make it easier to vote for everybody and to register, same day registration, lots of things we could do.
So there'll be a little bit of a changing face of city council come next term. And we don't know exactly all what's going to happen. There could be some challengers that get put in the mix on many different levels, but just for now, kind of as the primary just ended this past week, do you have any kind of preliminary thoughts on the changing face of city council?
Well, it reminds you why we have elections, that even with a low turnout, change happens and people's campaigns matter. You know, when I was elected, I was kind of an outsider a little bit to the powers that be. And I think this election, when you had four new council members out of nine, one of which was an open seat, but three of which were in the primary, a defeat of incumbents, some long-term incumbents. I mean, I think there's maybe a little signal that people want to keep seeing change happen. Change is good. Four new council members, I'm told, is more than we've had since at least the early 90s. So it's been quite a while. This is a pretty substantial change. They're all talented people. All the candidates were really impressive people, and I look forward to working with them.
Thought we'd get a quick update on the convention center. The last time we were at a public information forum, a lot of people got to come up, and there were a bunch of drawings all over the wall. I did hear that May would be maybe the next step, but there was no definite date or anything. Do you have any updates on what the next step is?
Well, you're right. There were a whole bunch of different pictures put on the wall, and then a bunch of them came off as we were zeroing down on what seemed to be the right approach. There are still several kind of design options in play. And like anybody who's been through a cafeteria line, sometimes your appetite is bigger than your budget, or your eyes are bigger than your stomach, as they say. So we have to do some engineering, thinking about cost, thinking about options for funding. And that's going to happen through May. There is a meeting, I think, of the steering committee late this month in May. There'll be another big session publicly planned in July. But there's still a lot of work to do. It's exciting to see the opportunities start to shape, but there's a lot of water still to go under this bridge before we get there.
The new development was the fact that the city bought another parcel of land a little closer to downtown, where I think Campus Costumes is. That there's a law firm there,
Bunger
too.
Bunger Robertson Campus Costumes.
Yeah. But there's also a lot of land already owned by the county, or is it county or city?
It's a mix, county, city, and others.
A mix in that area that actually goes further, that would be further south. Right. So if the convention center moves a little bit closer to downtown, what are there, I guess some of the concern I heard about later is, what about all that land that's already there?
Well, you know, when we're looking at a convention center, and that's a lot of what the last charrette and public input was, we're looking at a 50-year choice, probably at least, of where we want this building to be. So it's real important to think about the best orientation to the city, to the downtown, to the current assets that we have. And that's what we did. And actually, the public looked a lot. We actually had, it's interesting, the map of the current convention center, there was a block north, a block east, a block west, and a block south. So you could look all four directions of where it ought to be. And that was a lot of the public debate and steering committee review over the past few weeks. It did look like, and the public generally felt that, having the convention center of gravity closer to downtown is a very positive thing, so that visitors and people at those events are literally a stone's throw from the square. That changes the experience versus being south of the convention center, so you really don't even see the downtown stuff. So it's all still to be worked out. But I think the other point to make is it's been terrific to assemble all that land for possible use and for possible future use, but any land that either the city or the county or the convention center doesn't need can be sold and put back into use over time.
That's true too. Kind of segue into parking, because in that area is also 4th Street parking garage that's being decommissioned right now and plans for a new garage there. But it'd be right across from the convention center. So there's a lot of opportunity to kind of make that work too, correct? And is that happening?
Yes, the 4th Street garage, I'm glad the council agreed on the second round to we do have to decommission it and to rebuild it. We're looking at exactly what the footprint will be, exactly the height to get the appropriate number of spaces. But that will serve not only the current users of that garage and Fountain Square Mall and others, but it does give us an opportunity to use it in some degree for the convention center, if there's a new hotel and that kind of thing. So in the connectivity from that garage, both south and to the west, is pretty good for that. Mm-hmm.
There's a bank and I think a realtor's office too that sits in between there. Is the city pursuing looking into those parcels as well?
Well, Joe, we're always looking at stuff, but I wouldn't want to tell you that. I mean, no, I think the garage itself is, the footprint will either be what it is or extend down to 3rd Street, which we think is probably the smart thing to do. But that's all we need to do for that garage. Now, if a big convention center comes, there's probably going to be in a hotel, there's going to be need to look at more parking. We have tons of open space right now for surface parking, but in time we'll probably want to do a structure again.
So is the city in negotiations with any of that land there that'd be south of the 4th Street parking garage?
Well, most of the block south of the 4th Street parking garage is already owned by the convention center family, if you will.
Well, I'm talking about that parcel where there's a realtor.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We are. Okay. I mean, I think we've been in discussions. That's a really important way to get a more efficient garage, reach from 3rd Street to 4th Street, and we're trying to get that resolved.
And then what about the next step? And the Trades District has a parking garage going up too, but I think the first thing was the site location for that.
So we're very excited. The Trades District is doing well. Just this morning I was at a board meeting for the Dimension Mill, the mill as we call it, and they're doing well. They have over 200 members and new companies coming in, and actually companies graduating already, some from that place. And parking is important for all the jobs that we want to see there. So the choice between two different spots for a garage is still underway. I expect that'll get resolved in the next few weeks, I think. But I expect we'll see the 4th Street garage with the pedal down the hardest to get, because that's a little pain point right now. Up in the Trades District, it's not a pain point because there never has been a garage there. So, but both of those should be underway and I hope done by next year.
And the 4th Street garage could have that component of a retail space or multi-use.
Both of these garages are going to be garages.
Both.
They'll have some retail, they'll have a lot of bike and electric plug-ins and solar panels and bathrooms and other things that will be new kinds of amenities that'll make them not your grandfather's garage.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to get your, on the topic of parking, I want to get your take on this. From what I read in the Herald Times, a longtime marketing company, Hennepin, mm-hmm. announced that they're going to move from this complex here, which is in Showers, just due to lack of parking and options. And it just kind of furthers this discussion of parking in downtown, where it seems like it's choking city businesses, but then yet you hear the discussion about the environment and how down the road, why is the city building all this parking if it may not be something needed? So it sounds like a two-sided option of how do you please both sides?
Well, I guess I think about it, I sometimes say we're a both and community. We're not an either or community. And we have to live in the world we live in. I am deeply, personally, and as mayor, committed to climate change and responding to that. We have done more with solar. We're investing major amounts in trails and connectivity and in reducing the need for car travel. And that's the right thing to do. And we will continue to do that. On the other hand, part of sustainability is jobs and the economy. And it's really important that our downtown core, which has developed over generations and decades of really hard work of people, that we keep that a vibrant place for jobs, for retail, for living. And that does require, in the world we live in, some way to manage cars. I think the report you had from Hennepin is a kind of a reality shot that says, look, they're a young company, they believe in climate change, they're all progressive folks, but they say we have a lot of people who they can't take the bus, they live too far to walk or drive, ride, and so we need parking. And I think those are both true. We have to be committed to sustainability as we are as a community, as I am as a mayor, but we also have to recognize this transition period, we can't cut our nose off to spite our face and pretend that if we just drop all parking spaces that somehow the economy will adjust reasonably to that. So it's a both and we're gonna keep working on it, and there are different valid judgments on the right balance on that, and we'll continue to have those discussions.
It's been a few months since we talked about the city police union contract. I know there's been a dispute over wages and manpower, and now there's a conflict resolve happening right now. Do you have any updates today on that you can give us?
No new updates, no. Joe. Okay. It's not unheard of. We have negotiations with labor unions. There are three major ones that we have contracts with. Two of them are under contract, and we've recently renegotiated them. This third one, the police, we've had some issues with pay, with other issues. I wouldn't call them major cataclysmic, just differences. And if you do have a disagreement, a couple things happen. One, the current contract stays in place, so all the terms and all the conditions of the current contract stay in place until it's resolved. And two, you can move it to a mediator, and that's the step we're going to now.
The police make claims that Bloomington is 15 of 19 in the state in officer pay, staffing lower than other cities this size. Is that part of the dispute, and what's the city's response
to
that? Sure.
Well, as you might guess, there's often, yes, disputes about pay rates and pay amounts. The city has done a lot with salary studies, including our police and public safety officers, as well as our whole city, to look at in a systematic way, are we where we ought to be compared to our peer cities? We believe we are. I wish I could pay everybody more because people work hard, and we have an outstanding police department here that does great work. In terms of level of police officers, there's different ways to count that. Often people don't count the Indiana University police force when they're looking at our population and comparing ratios of different cities. They don't look at the kind of community that we have. I'm glad our crime rate is going down. Ultimately, we don't hire police just to have a ratio. We want public safety, and that's what we're focused on, is trying to make our town, our community safer, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood. And we live in a very safe community, and we'll keep the police do a great job. I work with them every day, and we'll continue to work with them, and I'm sure we'll get this resolved in the months ahead.
Let's move over to the fire department, because there was just more recent news about automatic aid agreements ending with county fire departments, and this could affect some of the insurance premiums for residents who are kind of right outside that line of the city and county. So why did the city not work on keeping those agreements instead of ending those?
Yeah, actually, we have been working on keeping those agreements. It's kind of a little bit of an arcane relationship in all these fire departments. The first thing I'd like to say is what we call mutual aid is in place and hasn't been changed and will stay in place. And mutual aid is what happens, what most of us think about, when a fire department responds to an event and says, oh my goodness, we need help. They get on the radio, everybody shows up. That is the case yesterday, today, and tomorrow. That mutual aid where, hey, if something happens that we need help, we all run to help. That's what first responders do. Automatic aid is a little different. Automatic aid is where the dispatch system itself, if it gets a call from, 417 West 7th Street, who does it call first to go to that, to respond to that emergency? And under automatic aid, the call goes not to the jurisdiction in which that address sits, but to a different place. That's sometimes because they're closer, because of a station, or various reasons where, for whatever reason, it may be quicker to call somebody else. For 2 years, we've been working from the city to try to make sure that automatic aid was put in place. It was never formalized and never has been formalized. And for 2 years we've been working to try to get automatic aid in the right areas of the city and the county to be put in place. It's been difficult for our county fire departments have not been able to meet the standards in some ways of staffing, equipment, those kinds of things, because they're a different kind of fire department. So what actually unfortunately happened was one of the fire departments outside the city said, we do have automatic aid in place. The insurance agents called to check with the city, and the city said, no, we actually don't. We're working on it, but we don't have it. And we had to inform the insurance adjusters and the other departments that that's not in place yet. It may be able to get in place, but it's not there yet, and we're working on it.
It just had, after reading the report, that the county fire departments weren't happy on the way it unfolded, and they blamed a little bit of an annexation issue with the state and some new laws. Is this part of any type of annexation strategy on the city's part?
No, it's actually not. Annexation does affect who gets what fire coverage. It typically does. If you're put into the city, you get city fire department. If you're not, you don't, typically. What this actually came because 2 years ago, our fire department noticed that we don't have automatic aid agreements in place, and we began a process to say what it'll take to get them in place. That process was going, but it wasn't done, and there was not an imminent sense of that. But then we had this report that someone said they were in place, and that prompted us to have to say they're not. One example would be, it's actually probably not smart if you don't have an automatic aid agreement to send your fire truck to somebody else's scene, because if anything bad were to happen, it would be like, well, why did you automatically go to that scene? You don't have an agreement to do that. If you caused damage or you didn't get there in the right way, there could be a lot of legal liability. So we want to make sure that's responsible.
We have a few questions from residents I want to get to. This is from Anthony, writes in, receiving the grant for an electric transit bus last year was a great thing. He's curious to when we might see the arrival of the new electric bus.
Buses take a long time to build. They have a long lead time. I don't think it will even arrive this year. One of the other things that you have to do when you get a fully electric bus, this would be our first one, you have to redo your, as you might imagine, your electric system at the transit station where the buses are housed overnight. So they have to upgrade the electrics. I think maybe 2020 we'll see the first one. And this is really, we're trying both electrics and maybe compressed natural gas buses. We kind of have to figure out which is the right way to go. So this is our first electric bus to see how that works.
Okay. Ryan emails in and wants to know if streetlights will be added to the busy bypass now that the hospital will soon be there.
I will have to get back to Ryan. I don't know. I know there's a lot of planning on all the mobility and connections that will happen on the bypass.
But we'll lots have to get going on there. He also adds, no lights were planned on the first Bloomington exit overpass bridge. If you're headed south on I-69, that's one I know too, is very dark. Can the city make the state accountable for adding lights on that ramp?
You know, I try to talk to the state about I-69. Sometimes they don't always agree with us, but I'm happy to check into that. That is basically all federal and state highway determinations. We can make our views known, and happy to do so.
Steven emails in, wants to know if there's anything with the gigabyte internet drive for Bloomington. Says happy in Bloomington and the mayor's performance.
Well, I don't have any news. We continue to work on that. I do continue to believe, as I have for several years, that digital infrastructure is really important for our future. It's complicated, and we're still working on it.
Okay. David writes in recent years, Bloomington has witnessed a large surge in luxury, so-called market-based housing. At roughly the same time, the university has embarked on a capital improvement, including the construction of student housing. So does the mayor consider this focused solution to be a perceived housing shortage justified given the lack of affordable and subsidized housing? And how do you feel about the continued persistence of the imbalance of addressing housing needs in Bloomington?
Affordable housing is a big challenge in Bloomington. I work on it every week and think about it every day. There are two main ways you respond to affordable challenges, and we are the most expensive market in the state of Indiana. One, you just increase supply. Hopefully by increasing supply, you can lower the pressure on units and lower some prices in general. Two, you have special programs that try to help make affordability happen. the large student complexes are essentially that first piece of that puzzle. They help create more supply in the community that meets the market. Now, we actually do work with some of those large projects to support affordability as well. You know, probably know Evolve and some others we're talking to where the big student housing developers help support affordable housing. We're going to be working on this every day, every week, every year. This is not a problem that you solve. It's a problem that you treat and improve year by year, and we're going to keep working at it.
And I probably should mention, I don't know that we covered the Switchyard apartment. Is that an affordable
Switchyard apartments? Those are permanent affordability. Starting with 8 apartments, hopefully eight more in round 2, right on the Switchyard in land donated by the city. And that will help make sure 16 families can live right next to the Switchyard Park, which will be great.
And there's an agreement with Habitat for Humanity with the city.
We have a partnership with Habitat we'll be announcing very shortly to also improve home ownership opportunities for working, low-income and working families. You know, affordable housing ranges from kind of chronically homeless people who just need help getting off the street to two-income working families who still can't make ends meet and everything in between. And all those strategies and efforts are going to keep going.
But I think that's, you know, maybe what David is in his question is asking is, you know, what is affordable, and you know, do some of these that are labeled affordable, are they really affordable to people?
Well, it's a fair question. I mean, affordable housing, you can have, as I said, you can have two working parents with kids who are paid above living wage, who are still struggling to find a place. It's hard to find a home to buy in Bloomington, for example, if you don't have high income. So affordability ranges from people making above the average to people making zero a year. And in that whole range, we have needs. We've created more than 600 bedrooms of affordable housing in the last 3 years. That's good, but it's just a start. You know, we have to do hundreds and hundreds more. It's a cost of a very popular community. Where, you know, if you don't have any affordable housing issue, it probably means people aren't aiming to live there. So there's a lot of housing that's available. The fact that we have a very big challenge in affordability is because a lot of people want to live here. And we want to include and open our arms to people who want to join the community.
I know we're over on time. I just had one more thing that came out today from the city, a partnership with Area 10, IU Health to pilot a new senior center. There really isn't a community, centralized location community center now, is there?
Well, it's been a few years since there was a downtown location. We have Twin Lakes Rec Center for a lot of seniors and others in Ellisville, but we are gonna try this pilot in a more centrally located place, easy to get to with Area 10. I'm excited IU Health and Area 10 together with the city. Pilot, see what seniors are interested in, see if it works. So we'll try that out this summer, and then over the next few months after that, we'll see what people like and what makes sense for the long haul.
And what's interesting about it is that it's more of a you call it a pilot. So it sounds like something that could happen relatively quickly, but yet maybe not what people are thinking of right now.
Well, it just means it may not be permanent. We do want to try it out, see what services, programs, kind of location people like. Get some feedback. If it's hugely popular and people are flocking to it, then we'll say, well, that's pretty popular. Let's figure out how we keep going. If it's not as popular, that may say, well, let's tweak it or try something different. So all you seniors, get out there and see if you like this kind of project.
And there's no idea of where yet it would be or how much it would cost the city right now.
It's not a lot of money for the pilot. We don't yet know exactly where it'll be located, somewhere either in the mall or the downtown or in between, probably something like that. And we'll get the final details in the weeks ahead.